welcome to Backchat from the Bristol Radio Co-op.
Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, and Radio Verulam in St Albans, and to our listeners in Swindon.
I'm Kay Stangadaffy.
And I'm Dana McAleer.
You know, yes, it's a sort of a dark corner of his output, sort of. I mean, I could find some people who could name one or two, possibly three titles, but when I told them there were 13, they did, yes, it's a very similar expression to yours. Yes, the eyebrows sort of go up a bit. 13, yes.
Coming up in the programme, Natalie Artemis Pollock is set to form a society to honour the great composer Gustav Holst.
I think sausage and mash is a classic comfort food. The, you know, lovely flavour of the sausage mixed with mashed potato, creamy, buttery. It's a real comforting flavour. And even in the summertime, it's incredible how many we sell.
Yes, we're back with our austerity food advice. And this week, you can find out how to cook the best sausage and mash.
Beginnings of modern pop music was happening with skiffle and rock and roll. And that was how it started. I was at a youth club in Westbury Village, Westbury-on-Trim. And we had a youth club leader who was very enlightened for the time. And he persuaded us to form a youth club skiffle group. And that's how it all started.
Mike Tobin joins us later on in the show. He's been in the music business for many years and tells us about some of the great people he's met in the world of music.
I've Neil Dennison in the studio with me here, who's starting up a new company called Urban Pursuit. Would you like to give us the basics of what your company's planning to do?
Sure, yeah. Urban Pursuit is a community interest company that I started last autumn after a 15-year teaching career. Basically, I've spotted a big need in Bristol for children who are at risk of exclusion from school. So I wanted to do something about it. I gave up my career and have set up this organisation, which is a not-for-profit organisation. We offer alternative education programmes for these children that are at risk, using outdoor pursuits, extreme sports, a mix really of traditional sorts of outdoor activities that you might get, as well as more contemporary urban activities to try and re-engage them with their education.
What sort of specific urban activities? Could you give us some examples of the more modern?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of things that kids are into these days, I guess, in Bristol certainly are a lot of skateboarding, a lot of scooting. There's a increase in the free running and parkour sports. BMXing has sort of transformed over the years and has become quite big again, and these sort of stunt bikes with the low seats. So there's quite a lot of very active, very dynamic urban sports happening around this city and other cities.
Well, it sounds like an interesting mix, definitely. So was there something in particular which spurred you to start this programme? Is it something that you've been planning for a while? Was there any sort of event which made you really think, OK, now's the time to get started in this?
Well, I guess I have a passion for young people and their education. I believe that doing adventurous activities and taking risks is a really important part of the diet that young people need. And I guess I wasn't seeing enough of that in the mainstream education system, and was forever trying to change it from within and not really succeeding. So I just sat down with my wife one day. We said, look, you know, what is it we're really, really passionate about? What should we really be focusing our lives on? And we decided that we'd both like to be part of something that involved children who were on the edge, a bit vulnerable, with outdoor pursuits. We're both passionate about extreme sports ourselves, and it's something we feel we can share with young people. So after a long process of thinking very carefully about whether or not to give up my career, finally took the jump and handed in my notice last February. And here we are on a long journey.
Wow, yeah. It's not completely active yet, the organisation. You're holding trials at the moment. I believe you've got 9 kids working with you at the moment. Is that right?
Yeah. We've got 3 children from 3 different schools, 9 in total from around the city. And there's 5 days of trials happening over 5 weeks. So the children have been involved in a range of different activities around the city. Rock climbing, bushcraft, sailing, mountain biking. In fact, we were down at the campus skate park doing skateboarding, scooting, that sort of stuff. So yeah, it's good sort of range of stuff. Trials really are about us testing out all of our procedures and operations. to, yeah, just to make sure that we're in a really good place to offer a quality vision from the autumn.
Do you see this as a response maybe to the new government? Was there anything about the riots recently, the student riots and then the London riots, which spurred you on as well? Was that something that you think maybe the government didn't respond to properly?
There's certainly a really big interest, I think, in society about what we do about the problem of young people, particularly young people that coming out of the education system without employment become really disenfranchised with the whole education system. I wouldn't say it was a direct response to the government's lack of or good sort of response to the riots. You know, the riots do show us something about the state of the nation and the state of the way young people are coming out with poor outcomes. We're failing around 50% of children and we're telling them that they're failures. The education system is telling them that they're failures. And that is unacceptable. We've got so much potential in amongst our young people in this nation to be good contributors to society. So it does frustrate me a little that our education system just keeps on trying to fill young people's minds with lots of things that we think that they need to learn, but actually we should be drawing things out of them more, making them more creative. We need more entrepreneurs in this country. We need more people making jobs than taking them. And actually we've got an education system that encourages the opposite. We need the government actually to start recognising that as well. Yeah, I think the movement at the moment politically is going in the opposite direction to the way it should be going. Will only serve to stifle creativity, I believe. So we need some radical rethinks, I think, around the whole education system.
I think it's great there's people out there looking for a solution to these issues. It's certainly reassuring, and it sounds like something that young people would, something they would be genuinely quite excited about, extreme sports, urban, as well as you mentioned, the more traditional aspects, sailing, bushcraft, we were talking about earlier. I think it sounds like a really great mix. And if all goes to plan, are you hoping that other cities, perhaps, in a few years?
Yeah, we've got big plans, actually. We're hoping to actually develop a quite sizable urban adventure complex in the heart of the city that will actually help us to generate commercial revenue to support the education work that we do. And as part of that, we're hoping that we're going to create basically a youth hub, a youth destination in the heart of the city that will have a massive draw factor and will be very visible to other cities around the nation. And we hope it'll be a model that others will want to replicate.
So if any schools or academies out there want to get in touch, what should they do?
If schools are interested in what we've got to offer and have children that are at risk of exclusion, particularly sort of in the earlier stages of the secondary phase, sort of years 7, 8 and 9, 11 to 13, 14-year-olds. Mm. We have a website, urbanpursuit.co.uk, which has all our information on it. And it's also a website that the general public can look at if they want to support us. If there are lots of different ways that people can support our work, through social networking, through giving, through volunteering, that sort of thing. Basically, schools and the local authority will refer students to us if they're at risk and can do so through our website.
Brilliant. So www.urbanpursuit.co.uk.
That's right.
Neil, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
That was Dannon talking to Neil Dennison about his community interest company, Urban Pursuits. Our next feature is about the composer Gustav Holst. But first, a track from the Planet Suite. It's Neptune, and there'll be a reference to this coming up.
Thank you. My name is Natalie Artemis Pollack. I'm from Canada, from Southern Ontario, not far from Toronto. My connection to English music is love of Holst, and I was here at the University of Surrey from 1999 to 2007, and I was doing musicological research into Holst, but particularly into his operas. You know, yes, it's a sort of a dark corner of his output, sort of. I mean, I could find some people who could name one or two, possibly three titles, but when I told them there were 13, they did, yes, it's very similar expression to yours. Yes, the eyebrows sort of go up a bit. 13, yes. Yes, in fact, there were. He, in fact, loved opera very, very much. He was very keen on writing good opera.
Can you tell us one of his operas, his most famous?
Possibly the most famous would be Savitri from, I believe it was 1927. And he was sort of honing his skills and becoming sort of the Holst. The Holst we know, of course, is The Planets, isn't it? And this was 1918, but this is almost a decade later. Mature man, you know, honing his skills, mature musician. And at this point, he wanted to have smaller forces at work. So he had a chamber orchestra for this opera, chamber, and they were to be on the stage, in fact, not hidden from the audience, but on the stage. And three singers, Savitri and her husband, Satyavan, and Death, who appears as a personage, as a character in this drama. And also, if anyone knows the end of Neptune from Planets, I think everyone does know, he loved his hidden choruses, Holst did, and there is a female chorus, again, hidden chorus, somewhere in the background for certain effects at certain times.
How popular is Holst in Canada? Is he very well known over there?
It's similar to other places. If someone knows Holst, they probably know The Planets first and foremost. It also depends, are you talking to a musician and what instrument do they play? Because sometimes if they're a choral singer, they will know possibly the part songs or some other wonderful. There's, of course, there's a great tradition of choral music in English music in England. Holst certainly contributed a great amount to that. So there are people who sing in choirs who know a lot of the works, Hymn of Jesus, the Choral Symphony, the Ode to Death, which I don't think is performed that often, but there are all the part songs for female voices, which, thanks to the St. Paul's Girls' School, he didn't like the material people were sending him that they thought were appropriate for girls to sing, and he thought it was rather ridiculous, frankly, and he said, well, I'll just write them my own, and lucky for us, because it's a wonderful body of work. He held several posts, but that's the only one he held right to his death. He did teach at Brook Green and in other places, and also not as teacher, but as organist in several places. So when he lived in Thaxted, he was organist there as well. But his greatest influence as a teacher was definitely at St. Paul's.
Do you think there's a revival of English music in the world today for that period in our musical history?
Well, I'm not sure about in general, overall in the world. There should be, but that's certainly my opinion. Great music, like the music we're hearing today, Bliss, and the many great people that were lost during the First World War, contemporaries and friends in some cases, of Holst and Vaughan Williams. There should be a revival. There are many works that deserve to be known, and people are concert goers, and this is true of Canada, maybe it is the same here. Concert goers tend to be nervous of things they don't know. They will go to hear things they already know. You know, I like what I know and I know what I like. This sort of attitude, but they don't want to go out on a limb, so to speak, and try, I don't know this. Let's listen to it and see what we think, you know, and even if we may turn out not to like it, but there certainly should be a revival.
There seems to be a huge amount of music from that period that people have never heard, yes. Which is really beautiful.
It is very beautiful, and it's a lovely kind of harmony. It's a time when people have gone away from Teutonic sound, which is, of course, very beautiful. They have their own style. And, of course, in many countries as well, the influence of the folk music of the period, you know, of that country. The same thing was happening in the Czech Republic. I was just in Prague for 2.5 years. Composers who were influenced by Moravian, Silesian, Bohemian songs, and the Russians, of course, loved their folk music. And the same thing happened, of course, here, where and there are many suites, Vaughan Williams, Holst, and so on, that incorporated a lot of the folk music. So it became a very rich source.
Are you doing any further work on Holst?
Yes, well, I did some earlier on in the late 80s in Canada when I was in university there. I did what I call my autopsy of Egdon Heath because I was quite fascinated by that sound. I didn't know Holst very well at the time, and I was completely amazed when I heard Egdon Heath. It was unlike what I was expecting, absolutely, and I decided to sort of take it apart, so to speak, note by note, and look at it from the point of view of a piece without a key signature, see what I could find in note groupings and things like this that maybe weren't, right away, they were not evident to the ear. When I came to Surrey in 1999, it was, as I say, his operas. Now, I would like to return, if possible. It would be wonderful to. I want to keep my ties with England. It's not my family background. My family background is quite fixed in Eastern Europe with the Polish and Russian and Czech and the sort of thing. I would like to do more work on Holst. And my great plan has always been, for a long time, has been to start a Holst society. I know there's a wonderful Holst Foundation, I believe, or Holst Trust. But I believe he needs a society, ideally to link together with these other societies like the Bliss and the Ivor Gurney. And if we could, as one gentleman mentioned, the John Ireland Society, if we could bring that back as well. So there would be, oh, and there's the Vaughan Williams. So there is a connection between them, possibly. So yes, to work on a possible society for Gustav Holst, to encourage the performance of more music, things that are less well-known, things to do with his biography, his career, his life in general. And of course, we have Imogen Holst to thank for, I think, what most of what we know about him, because she was his, I think, greatest biographer, naturally. And also just in general, I'd like to do more research into some of his compositional style, because the transition from him as a young man to an older one, to a mature musician, was quite fascinating. He had his, referring back to opera, he had his sort of Gilbert and Sullivan phase. He just adored it, and he had that sort of style. And then he loved Wagner after a while, and so he loved his enormous orchestras and, you know, huge sections and things. And then you come to, as I said, 1927, Savitri, you have small chamber orchestra, 3 singers, no set, and a small chorus that you do not see, you know. So he was paring things down. It was quite amazing. And he was also a voracious reader, and was also influenced by a lot of things. He said, I'm sure I'm quoting this now from Imogen, who quoted her father, "I only study things that suggest music to me." So we had his interest in astrology, and there, from that, we got the planets. And then he was very, very influenced by his reading of Indian, the great epic poetry. He loved the stories in them. He wasn't trying to imitate Indian music. He was reacting as an Englishman, as a European. But he loved the stories. And again, we have, so many works that came from this. The Rig Veda hymns, the Vedic hymns, and at least 2 operas and many works like that. So, and then his time in Algeria, when he spent in Algeria. So he's a fascinating man. There's a lot of material there to study and to bring to the surface.
Thank you to Natalie Artemis Pollock. She was talking about the composer Gustav Holst. Over now to Slovenia. We're going to hear about this small country from Stuart Riddle, who has been working over there teaching English.
Hi, Stuart.
Hello.
Tell us about Slovenia. You've been working there a year.
Yeah, I've been teaching English. I did a course, a TEFL course, to teach English overseas. And Ljubljana, and the capital of Slovenia. And Slovenia generally is very, very beautiful and a very easy place to live. So I decided to go and spend my year there.
You told me, quite surprisingly, it's quite an affluent country.
Yeah, definitely compared with its neighbours, it does very well. It was always the most successful of the Balkan nations in terms of economics. It has lots of head offices for the whole region. At the moment, it has a lot of tourism also, quite high-class tourism. So, yeah, it does very well for itself. The quality of life there is extremely high, standard of living.
How many people live there?
Only 2 million. It's a really small country. It's kind of at the end of the Alps. It's squeezed between Italy and Austria and the Balkan countries. And it's very influenced by Italy and Austria because it's been owned by those nations and taken over and influenced very heavily by them.
Where do they get their money from, their economy? What's the main produce?
I don't know if I know hugely. What I would say is that the head offices of many, many chain companies right across the Balkans generally are in Ljubljana and Slovenia. And I think what is the point is that many of Slovene population are highly, highly educated. The vast majority speak English. The infrastructure is extremely good. And I think it's probably very attractive, therefore, to base your company in that part of the world. And it also has amazing links, of course, to Austria, to Italy and the rest of the EEC. At the moment, it's the only former Balkan nation in the EU. Croatia, I think, is joining next year. But at the moment, it's the only link that to West, if you like. So, yeah.
Can you tell us about National Health Service over there? Do they have one?
They do. They have a very successful one. It's at the moment, everything is free for everyone. Actually, absolute poverty in Slovenia is almost non-existent. There are poor people, of course, but it's come from a communist history. And in the last 20 years, things are changing and the richer are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, but like everywhere in the world. But the gap is still relatively small. And still, at the moment, universal services for the poorer are still available. Equally, like everywhere in Europe, there is a recession of some kind and they are less well off than they used to be. And there are pressures on these kind of services.
What about the politics? Do you know anything about that?
I do, but it's very hard to get a very realistic view because I talk to a lot of Slovenes a lot of the time and they will have very strong views about this. Of course, very educated Slovenes, those that I speak to. As a result, I get very biased views, probably. So most of the people there are very frustrated with how slow the political change is in Slovenia. One of the downsides can be that as administrative processes are huge, a bit of a hangover of communism times, and a little bit of corruption, a little bit of red tape, and nothing gets done ever. And so recently there was a change of government towards the right. I mean, it's still not very right-wing in compared with much of Europe, but towards the right from where they were. But people were very kind of blasé about it. They weren't really thinking that much had changed and that much was going to be different. One of the classics about politics in Slovenia is that they are obsessed with referendums. They have referendums all the time. They have a couple of years every year, and people have given up hope there's any point in having them whatsoever. The idea is that they're trying to embrace democracy in its purest sense, but actually they haven't really learned about, they haven't really embedded it into their systems, and people are going, what is this about? We ask for this to happen and it doesn't happen. And of course, the people who vote are people who strongly believe and are strongly able to vote, so they're all the people in Ljubljana, so the rest of the country get excluded from this kind of political system. So they've got a lot to work out. You know, I think in terms of politics, there's a lot to work on. There's a new country, 20 years, they'll change and improve as they go along.
What language do they speak?
Slovene. But like all small countries in Europe, Slovenes are unbelievable at languages, being languages. So English is extraordinarily high level across Slovenia, but also German, very well spoken. In Prekmurje, over in the east, it's very Hungarian focused. There's lots of Hungarian spoken, and then a little bit of Italian down the west coast. So a lot of languages are well spoken there, but Slovene is the language, which is related to Serbian, but very different language.
So do many young people leave the country to find work elsewhere?
Yeah, this is an increasingly worrying problem because there's work. There's this feeling that you can't really push yourself. So, for example, you can become the manager of a large corporation in Slovenia relatively easy because the competition is lower. However, it's still a small company in Europe. In terms, so if you want to really develop your career and push your skills, where do you go next? Do you go outside of Slovenia? So there is this move to for something bigger. There's a real complex there about the size of the country. For us visitors and tourists, it's a wonderful thing, but for locals, they're there's a real complex that they're missing out on something. So there's a real move often to go elsewhere and find new things.
So what do you like most about Slovenia?
Well, for me, it was the mountains. It's all about the mountains. It's a beautiful country. And there's no denying it. It's the end of the Alps. It's also on the coastline with Croatia, which everyone knows is phenomenally stunning. And there's the lakes, and it has a massive karst land. In fact, that's where the word karst comes from, Slovenia, limestone pavement. And there's huge, beautiful rolling hills, not flat and barren. It's very, very lush and very, very beautiful. And also it has a lot of sunshine. So it's the best of both worlds environmentally. Very wonderful.
And what about the town?
Stunning. Yeah, Ljubljana is gorgeous. It's utterly gorgeous. It's a very romance city, you know, in the vein of maybe Luxembourg or some other kind of grand, small European city. Paran on the coast is stunning. It's a medieval city and walled and peninsula into the Adriatic. So there's no denying that's stunning. Absolutely beautiful. The other cities are also very useful. Maribor and Tui have beautiful historic centres. But Slovenia is not about the cities. It's not about the cities at all. Slovenes are very outward-bound people. They love the countryside. They love being active. And they're in the mountains every weekend, as I was. The mountains are just beautiful. They're slightly more unique than Swiss and Austrian mountains for me, because Slovenia has both these large flat plains and then these sheer phenomenal mountains. So you can really get a perspective of how big these mountains are. You're not always in the mountains themselves, you go up to them and in. So they feel quite amazing, and they loop. Even from Ljubljana, you walk down the main street and ahead of you, you can see one of the largest mountains in Slovenia. It's a pleasure to see. Really beautiful on a clear day.
So it's easy to get to, isn't it?
Very easy to get to, 40 minutes down the road.
But what about flying from Britain? It's easy.
Oh, Slovenia, yeah. Generally, yeah, EasyJets fly there. So that's handy. But if that's not ideal for people, flying from London to Ljubljana, there are other options. Because it's a small country, you're also very close to Venice and Rijeka in Croatia, Klagenfurt and Graz in Austria, and Zagreb in Croatia. So you're surrounded by these amazing big cities that are very easy to fly to, and also are treats to visit themselves.
Thanks to Stuart Riddle there for a foreigner's viewpoint of Slovenia. We're back again with another tip on cheap food to cook in the age of austerity. This week, the tip is all about sausage and mash. We visit the Clifton Sausage Restaurant here in Bristol.
Simon Corey, and I run the Clifton Sausage Restaurant in Bristol, and we've been open here now for 10 years. Originally the idea was to have a restaurant that was accessible to everybody, that had products that people liked. And when we researched the market, we realised that sausages, and particularly premium sausages, were a growth area, and so we based our menu around sausage and mash. Popular, universal in their appeal, and with a plethora of flavours to suit everybody's taste. And since we opened 10 years ago, we've sold, well over 1.5 million sausages, I think was the last count, and rising, which is great. I think sausage and mash is a classic comfort food. The lovely flavour of the sausage mixed with mashed potato, creamy, buttery. It's a real comforting flavour, and even in the summertime it's incredible how many we sell. I think the best tips for sausages would be to have, firstly, buy the best sausages you can. We use always premium grade pork in our sausages, not too much filler, although typically English sausages do have a little bit of Ruskin to help soak up the juices and keep your sausage nice and plump. And here at the sausage, we grill all our sausages under a high grill. That's a nice way to get things done. Never prick the skins, because that way the lovely flavours and the juices run out of the sausages. And if they're good quality, they won't split or burst. So no need to prick the skins. It makes a great and an economic meal. For mashed potato, we source premium quality Maris Piper potatoes. I find they make a consistent mashed potato, and they're available pretty much all year round. And we boil those till they're just tender, and then they're mashed by hand using a potato ricer. To that we add fresh butter, and a local double cream and just a little bit of seasoning to make our basic mashed potato. A popular sort of variation on that in the restaurant is to add some chopped spring onions to that before we serve it, and that makes champ potatoes. And they're very popular, the crisp wider spring onion against the creamy mash. It's a nice contrast. But we, from time to time, make all sorts of different variations, adding things like whole grain mustard, chives. We sometimes add a little bit of cooked cabbage to make cold cannon, which is, again, a really nice accompaniment, particularly to things like sausage casserole, which is something we do in the restaurant, particularly in the autumn and winter months. Gravy, got to be onion gravy with sausages. And again, we make that in big batches with lots of onions sweated down so that they become nice and sweet and tender. And then we add that to a simple gravy made with beef stock, a little bit of flour and butter just to thicken it up, give that nice, glossy, rich texture which coats the sausages. Yeah, so the gravy really complements the sausage and mash, brings the whole dish together, creates a lovely meal, really. If people want to visit the restaurant, the best way is through our website, which is www.cliftonsausage.co.uk. And we've got our menus on there and our specials of the day. People can see what our restaurant's all about.
Bye-bye, baby doll, I find you too high class. I bought myself a ticket, but you won't let me pass. Champagne and caviar are all very grand, but I prefer just rocking to a rock and roll band. You find a joint at the hopping and a cat at the bopping, and there'll be no stopping me, wait and see. Lot of things I gotta do, go put on my dancing shoes, honey, I salute the blues, bye bye my baby. Oh, well, go and find a rich man, put your arms around him, tell him that you love him, and then go out and find him. Baby, with your riches, you'll find your happiness. But I still hear it rocking, cause it's what I love the best. In a joint, it's a hopping and a cat, it's a bopping, and there'll be no stopping me, wait and see. Lot of things I gotta do, go put on my dancing shoes, honey, I'll salute the blues, bye bye my baby. Bye-bye, baby doll, I find it too high class. I bought myself a ticket, but you won't let me pass. This pink champagne and caviar are all very grand, but I prefer just rocking to a rock and roll band. You find a joint, it's a hopping and a get, it's a bopping, and there'll be no stopping me, wait and see. Lot of things I gotta do, go put on my dancing shoes, honey, I'll salute the blues, bye-bye, my baby.
And here we have Mike Tobin, who's been in the music business for many years. So how long have you been in the music business? How did you start?
Longer than I care to admit. It started for me when I was a teenager in Bristol, way back in the 1950s. Really when the beginnings of modern pop music was happening with skiffle and rock and roll. And that was how it started. I was at a youth club in Westbury Village, Westbury-on-Trim. And we had a youth club leader who was very enlightened for the time, and he persuaded us to form a youth club skiffle group, and that's how it all started. So we learnt a few chords and off we went.
And I would imagine that you've seen quite a few greats in your time in the music business.
Well, I've certainly seen many, many great acts right the way back to when I was just a fan and I saw the Beatles at Bath Pavilion in 1964, for instance. Then I was still amateur. I had proper jobs as well during the daytime. But our band was very popular in Bristol, so we often got the support slot when a major act would come into town. So we supported the Rolling Stones twice, once at the Corn Exchange, which is now St. Nicholas Market, and once at the Colston Hall. So that was amazing for a kid in late teens, early 20s, to have that experience was absolutely amazing.
And what would you say your role in the music business is?
Well, now it's changed dramatically. Very briefly, what happened was that I was singing with various bands in Bristol throughout the 60s and then got involved with actually putting events and gigs on at various clubs and venues around the Bristol area. As a result of that, I got to know quite a lot of the agents and managers who are all based in London, and one of them invited me to go up and join his team in London because he needed an assistant and thought I was suitable for the job. So I left Bristol and moved up to London in 1970. And that was really my entry into the music business full time then. That became my job, my career. And I worked in various offices with various agents, various managers over the next several years. And then also worked for Richard Branson, Virgin Records. I worked for RCA Records for 4 years. That was a very exciting time throughout the 70s. So I'd given up singing then. I was basically on the other side of the counter, if you like, doing the business side of it. Throughout that time, though, I always kept a watch on Bristol because it's my hometown. I love it. I'm passionate about Bristol music and Bristol bands. And there was one in particular that I went on to manage, a band called Stackridge, who was formed in 1969. And I'm glad to say is still going strong to this very day and still making great music and producing great records. But during that time, obviously, you're working for major labels and so on, you do get to meet some and work with some very big stars. And I have some very fond memories, if you want to hear one or two of them.
Yes.
Okay, well, one I was very impressed with, and people will smile when I say this and wonder why, but I'll explain, was Dolly Parton. Now, Dolly was wonderful. She was just such a pleasure to work with. She was great fun, she was cooperative, and it was her first time in England, and I was on the tour with her throughout the time she was over here, organising her PR promotion. Another American act that I thought were absolutely wonderful was Hall & Oates, Daryl Hall and John Oates. Made some great records, and they were one of the best live bands that I ever saw.
And how would you say the music industry has changed over the course of you being in it?
Well, of course, technology now has changed with the internet and so on. That has changed the whole ball game incredibly, in many ways for the better, but in some ways for the detriment of the business, specifically because it's much more difficult for people to make money anymore, and that's particularly true of musicians, which is very sad. Musicians deserve to be paid as much as any other skilled trade, but they're expected to do stuff for nothing, which I think is outrageous, and I fight that as much as I can. But what's interesting is now, of course, with people youthful age, you know, you can make a great record in your bedroom using a computer and Pro Tools and you're away. And you can put that out on YouTube with a video and suddenly you've got tens of thousands of fans. The problem with it, though, is that, if you like, there's too much noise out there now because there's too much. Everybody can do it, therefore everybody's trying to do it, and obviously not all of it is very good. But how do you find the good stuff in amongst all the rubbish? That is the difficulty for music fans, but it's also the difficulty for people in the music business. Where do you find the next act?
So how do people in the music business generally find their next act?
Well, much the same way as it's always been. I mean, there's some aspects of the business haven't changed at all. It's become even more crucial now to be able to play well live, and so that's where they will go. If they get a sniff that an act is good because they're being talked about on Twitter or on Facebook, or there is even a very good video. It still doesn't guarantee that that band can play live or make more good records. So they will go and find them and have a look. And it still works that people who have a reputation in the business, good managers, good agents, who over the years have been associated with very successful acts, will be approached, and they will also be always on the lookout for artists and new acts. So that aspect of it hasn't changed very much. But what can happen occasionally, as we know, is that, particularly if it's an extremely exciting and unusual video, that will go viral. And with no help from the music industry at all, that's the people voting, if you like, by flicking a switch or pressing a button. And that can produce amazing results. And there's been some huge success stories going down that road.
So what do you think are the best things about the new technology which is enhancing the music business?
I think, well, it works in two ways. I think certainly as far as the internet is concerned, as I've already said, that gives the opportunity for lots of people to have a go and sometimes with amazing results. The other end of the spectrum, with the very, very big acts and the huge festivals, the technology now for the stage lighting and for the sound is just absolutely extraordinary. And so it's almost impossible to have a bad sound or a show from that point of view. Still means the artist has got to better perform and play properly and sing properly, but a lot of that can be hidden, if you like, by the technology of the lighting and So that's changed a lot.
And now back to Bristol. What do you think Bristol's role is in the music business?
Bristol has always been a hotbed of music. I mean, way back in the 50s, it was one of the main jazz cities in the UK. And just as with every other city in the late 50s, early 60s, Bristol had something like 300, 350 active bands, all great bands, most of them amateur, very few of them ever made any record, but they were working almost every night of the week, because if you went to a dance, there was a live band. It was as simple as that. There was no DJ playing records, you know? So that was always strong. But for some mysterious reason, when, obviously Liverpool being the typical one, but when Liverpool happened, Manchester, Birmingham, Sheffield, all the other major cities in the UK, at some time or other, the record industry based in London would go to that city to find and sign new bands. It didn't happen to Bristol. And it's a puzzle. We've never understood that, because the talent was here. However, not too many years ago, of course, we had the Wild Bunch, which moved on and became Massive Attack. You had Porter's Head, you had Tricky, and so on and so on. Then suddenly everybody's looking at Bristol, and there's a Bristol sound. A little bit late in the day, but Bristol finally became a major force internationally, and still is regarded as such. That is good, because it's focused a lot more energy on the city, and now the music scene in Bristol is fantastic. It's better than it's ever been. There's more live bands, there's more live venues, and that's all to be encouraged. It's really good. All we've got to do is make sure people go out and support those bands.
So the future for Bristol looks bright.
It does. It's looking good. I'm thrilled to bits to be back here involved in it all again, because I'm finding it as exciting as it's ever been.
Thanks very much, Mike, for coming in and sharing your musical life with us. We now have a reading from The Seven Pillars of Wisdom by T.E. Lawrence, otherwise known as Lawrence of Arabia. In this chapter, he describes the dehumanising experience of fighting in the First World War, and it's read by David Clark.
Some of the evil of my tale may have been inherent in our circumstances. For years we lived anyhow with one another in the naked desert, under the indifferent heaven. By day the hot sun fermented us, and we were dizzied by the beating wind. At night we were stained by dew and shamed into pettiness by the innumerable silence of stars. We were a self-centred army without parade or gesture, devoted to freedom, the second of man's creeds. A purpose so ravenous that it devoured all our strength, a hope so transcendent that our earlier ambitions faded in its glare. As time went by, our need to fight for the ideal increased to an unquestioning possession, riding with spur and rein over our doubts. Willy-nilly, it became a faith. We had sold ourselves into its slavery, manacled ourselves together in its chain gang, bowed ourselves to serve its holiness with all our good and ill content. The mentality of ordinary human slaves is terrible. They have lost the world, and we had surrendered not body alone, but soul to the overmastering greed of victory. By our own act, we were drained of morality, of volition, of responsibility, like dead leaves in the wind. The everlasting battle stripped from us care of our own lives or of others. We had ropes about our necks and on our heads prices which showed that the enemy intended hideous tortures for us if we were caught. Each day some of us passed, and the living knew themselves just sentient puppets on God's stage. Indeed, our taskmaster was merciless, merciless, so long as our bruised feet could stagger forward on the road. The weak envied those tired enough to die, for success looked so remote and failure a near and certain, if sharp, release from toil. We lived always in the stretch or sag of nerves, either on the crest or in the trough of waves of feeling. This impotency was bitter to us, and made us live only for the seen horizon, reckless with spite we inflicted or endured, since physical sensation showed itself meanly transient. Gusts of cruelty, perversions, lusts ran lightly over the surface without troubling us. For the moral laws which had seemed to hedge about these silly accidents must be yet fainter words. We had learned that there were pangs too sharp, griefs too deep, ecstasies too high for our finite selves to register. When emotion reached this pitch, the mind choked, and memory went white till the circumstances were humdrum once more. Such exaltation of thought, while it let adrift the spirit and gave it license in strange airs, lost it the old patient rule over the body. The body was too coarse to feel the utmost of our sorrows and of our joys. Therefore, we abandoned it as rubbish. We left it below us to march forward, a breathing simulacrum, on its own unaided level, subject to influences from which, in normal times, our instincts would have shrunk. The men were young and sturdy, and hot flesh and blood unconsciously claimed a right in them and tormented their bellies with strange longings. Our privations and dangers fanned this virile heat, in a climate as racking as can be conceived. We had no shut places to be alone in, no thick clothes to hide our nature. Man in all things lived candidly with man.
David Clark there reading from The Seven Pillars of Wisdom by T.E. Lawrence. And now we've got The Endless Road by Tim Burrows.
Here I walk by the railside with all my hopes so deep inside. My future lies on the horizon far, an endless road that never ends, side a railroad track that never bends. This makes my soul look to the sky.
Backchat this week. Studio guests were Neil Dennison from Urban Pursuits, Mike Tobin from Bristol's music scene. David Clark read an extract from The Seven Pillars of Wisdom by T.E. Lawrence. Features by Anthea Page. Music by Tim Burrows. Studio engineer was Xanos. I'm Case Langadaffy.
And the producer was Anthea Page. And I'm Dana McAleer. And we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.